News Update. A rights group on Thursday said Israel has caused a forced displacement of civilians in Gaza to such an extent that it constitutes war crimes and crimes against humanity. Reuters correspondent Zachary Goldman reports.
Israel claims that it set up an evacuation system to allow Palestinians, civilians in Gaza to seek safety.
Human Rights Watch said its investigation showed that Israel failed to show its efforts to relocate Palestinian civilians met the required conditions under international law. Adam Kugel is the deputy director of the group's Middle East and North Africa division.
Our report and documentation shows that Israel has failed to meet the burden. Therefore, they are committing forced displacement, and because it's pursuant to a state policy, it is a crime against humanity.
Israel, in response, accused the organization of using rhetoric that is, quote, completely false and detached from reality. Israel invaded the Gaza Strip last year after Hamas gunmen led an assault on communities in southern Israel, killing around 1,200 people, according to Israeli authorities, and abducting more than 250 as hostages. Since then, the Israeli campaign has killed more than 43,500 people, according to Gaza health authorities. The onslaught destroyed much of the enclave's infrastructure, forcing most of the population's 2.3 million people to move several times. For the past month, Israeli troops have moved tens of thousands of people from areas of Gaza's north as they have sought to destroy Hamas forces the military says are regrouping. Human Rights Watch said the displacement of Palestinians, quote, is likely planned to be permanent in the buffer zones and security corridors, an action it said would amount to, quote, ethnic cleansing. The Israeli military has denied seeking to create permanent buffer zones. Foreign Minister Gideon Saar said on Monday that Palestinians displaced from their homes in northern Gaza would be allowed to return at the end of the war.
Reuters correspondent Zachary Goldman. This is VOA News. U.S. President-elect Donald Trump says he'll nominate vaccine skeptic Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to be America's health secretary. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
Kennedy would head the massive Health and Human Services Department, which oversees everything from drug, vaccine, and food safety to Medicare.
We will make Americans healthy again.
Kennedy endorsed Trump in August after dropping his own independent presidential bid. The son of the late Attorney General is one of the world's most prominent anti-vaccine activists and has long advanced the debunked idea that vaccines cause autism. During a House hearing, California Democrat Robert Garcia was aghast.
That someone that wants to gut the NIH, HHS, and other services could be put in charge of health of any kind in this country.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
Smog has descended on New Delhi earlier than usual this year, impacting visibility, including near the Indian city's international airport. Reuters correspondent Rachel Graham has more.
Smog caused a sharp drop in visibility in Delhi this week, causing a raft of delays at the city's airport. More patients flocked to hospitals, particularly children. One pediatrician told a news agency he'd seen a spike in asthma attacks. Officials blamed high pollution, combined with humidity, low wind speed, and a slight drop in temperature. Daily air quality in the region crossed into the severe category for the first time this season. Air quality monitoring group IQ Air ranked New Delhi the second most polluted major city on Thursday, behind Lahore in neighboring Pakistan. Dense smog has engulfed other parts of northern India, such as the states of Punjab and Uttar Pradesh, where visibility fell to zero in some areas on Thursday.
Reuters correspondent Rachel Graham. China's president will unveil a megaport in Peru, but locals say they're being left out. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
Chancay is a remote fishing town on the edge of Peru's coastal desert, where a third of all residents have no running water, but is now being transformed into a huge deep water port to cash in on the inexorable rise of Chinese interests in resource-rich South America. Local fisherman Julio Cedar tells the AP all kinds of fish used to come. They destroyed an appropriated part of the sea. The megaport, a $1.3 billion project, majority owned by the Chinese shipping giant Cosco, wants to turn the outpost of bobbing fishing boats into an important node of the global economy. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Q Human Rights Watch accuses Israel of war crimes.
Our report and documentation shows that Israel has failed to meet the burden. Therefore, they are committing forced displacement, and because it's pursuant to a state policy, it is a crime against humanity.
Moving to green energy and protecting poor countries from climate-related disasters will be expensive.
At least $1 trillion per year will be needed by the end of the decade.
And the U.S. reveals that the hack of American telecommunications systems was bigger than originally thought.
The hackers would have been able to access customer call records, infiltrate private communications, and they said that applied to government officials and high-ranking politicians.
Today is Friday, November 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Alexis Strope.
And I'm Steve Karish. The fighting between Israel and Hamas rages on, as it has for over a year, and for just about as long Israel has faced and denied accusations of war crimes in Gaza. On Thursday, Human Rights Watch issued more accusations. Reuters' Zachary Goldman has that story.
A rights group on Thursday said Israel has caused a forced displacement of civilians in Gaza to such an extent that it constitutes war crimes and crimes against humanity.
Israel claims that it set up an evacuation system to allow Palestinians, civilians in Gaza to seek safety.
Human Rights Watch said its investigation showed that Israel failed to show its efforts to relocate Palestinian civilians met the required conditions under international law. Adam Kugel is the deputy director of the group's Middle East and North Africa division.
Our report and documentation shows that Israel has failed to meet the burden. Therefore, they are committing forced displacement, and because it's pursuant to a state policy, it is a crime against humanity.
Israel, in response, accused the organization of using rhetoric that is, quote, completely false and detached from reality. Israel invaded the Gaza Strip last year after Hamas gunmen led an assault on communities in southern Israel, killing around 1,200 people, according to Israeli authorities, and abducting more than 250 as hostages. Since then, the Israeli campaign has killed more than 43,500 people, according to Gaza health authorities. The onslaught destroyed much of the enclave's infrastructure, forcing most of the population's 2.3 million people to move several times. For the past month, Israeli troops have moved tens of thousands of people from areas of Gaza's north as they have sought to destroy Hamas forces the military says are regrouping. Human Rights Watch said the displacement of Palestinians, quote, is likely planned to be permanent in the buffer zones and security corridors, an action it said would amount to, quote, ethnic cleansing. The Israeli military has denied seeking to create permanent buffer zones. Foreign Minister Gideon Saar said on Monday that Palestinians displaced from their homes in northern Gaza would be allowed to return at the end of the war.
That's Zachary Goldman of Reuters reporting for us.
As the world authorities on the climate are meeting at COP29 in Baku, Azerbaijan, one thing has become very clear. This will be an expensive problem to solve. Sean Hogan of Reuters explains.
If poorer states are to move to greener energy and protect against extreme weather, at least $1 trillion per year will be needed by the end of the decade. That's the warning to negotiators at COP29 on Thursday, as money becomes a central focus of the climate talks being held in Azerbaijan. But negotiators at the UN climate conference risk being overshadowed by political spats. France's climate minister has cancelled her trip to the summit after Azerbaijan's president accused France of crimes in its overseas territories in the Caribbean. Meanwhile, Argentina's government has also withdrawn its negotiators from talks, according to two diplomats at the event, although neither knew the reason why. Argentina's president, Javier Milei, has previously called global warming a hoax. Negotiators have been left fielding questions on the diplomatic issues.
I would like to propose that we stick to the today's thematic theme, which is finance.
Negotiators are trying to reach a deal on how much richer countries, development lenders, and the private sector must provide each year. A previous goal of $100 billion per year was met late in 2022, and in the form of loans rather than grants, something recipient countries say needs to change. A report from the independent high-level expert group on climate finance said the annual target figure would need to rise to $1.3 trillion a year by 2035, or more if countries drag their feet now.
Well, I'm kind of seeing some glum faces. There should be some energy in this room. And if we're to drive that those finance flows, it needs energy from many of you here.
Any deal is likely to be hard-fought, given a reluctance among many Western governments, bound by the Paris Agreement in 2015, to give more unless countries including China agree to join them. The United States' likely withdrawal from any future funding deal by incoming President Donald Trump has also cast a shadow over talks, raising pressure to find other ways to secure funds. EU negotiator Jacob Werksman said on Thursday that countries were still way off on agreeing a collective target.
It's been my experience that as long as there is a little bit more time to negotiate on something that's that complicated, we'll take it. So I don't think that we will completely close every issue this week, but I think that we will have developed a momentum that will ensure that we wrap it up, certainly in the early part of next week.
More countries said they would consider taxing polluters, but any agreement is unlikely this time around. Most of the world's climate-friendly spending is skewed towards major economies such as China and the United States. Africa's 54 countries received just 2% of global renewable energy investments over the last two decades.
Reuters' Sean Hogan with that story.
And just as climate discussions at COP29 are ongoing in Baku, about 3,700 kilometers to the southeast in New Delhi, smog has descended earlier than usual this year. It's impacting visibility at the city's international airport and sending hundreds of people, particularly children, to the hospital. In fact, the air quality monitoring group, IQ Air, ranked New Delhi as the second most polluted major city on Thursday. They say the most polluted city is Lahore in neighboring Pakistan. VOA's Sarah Zaman is in Pakistan, where experts say the problem that keeps returning every winter will get worse over time.
As winter arrives, large parts of Pakistan get shrouded in toxic smog, a mix of fog and dangerous pollutants that hurts the eyes, throat and lungs, landing many in hospitals. Bashir Ahmed had to seek emergency care.
I had health issues already. When I arrived in Lahore, it got worse because of pollution. I'm really suffering.
Air Quality Index, or AQI, reading above 300 makes air hazardous for breathing. Cities across the most populous province, Punjab, have crossed that limit several times recently. Record pollution has prompted officials to temporarily shut down schools, limit outdoor activities, and make government employees work from home. Environmental expert Ali Taqir Sheikh.
It is bringing our economy to standstill. Children cannot go to school. We cannot go to our offices. Airlines cannot operate. Trains stop 30 minutes before reaching Lahore, for hours. So in that sense, it is probably the worst crisis that we are facing.
Low-grade fuel in vehicles has long been the primary driver of year-round air pollution in Pakistan, followed by industrial emissions and waste burning. The problem becomes more visible in winters as cold, heavy air traps pollutants close to the ground. At the National Disaster Management Authority's National Emergencies Operations Center in Islamabad, experts predict the crisis will worsen in coming weeks. Technical lead Sayed Mohammed Tayyab Shah.
We see a more aggressive smog in the coming days and also in December as well.
Air quality readings vary widely among international satellites, third-party sensors, and the government's own few monitors. But Shah says it's clear the climate change data trends point to a troubling future.
We know that every year it will be more warmer than the previous year, so the future is more scary in terms of smog.
Sheikh says Pakistan needs long-term solutions and not temporary curbs.
First is the public transportation. Second is the improving quality of fuel. Third, making a quick transition towards decarbonizing our economy.
Pakistan's environmental officials say they are making strides as the province introduces a 10-year smog reduction plan. Imran Hamid Sheikh is the Director General of the Punjab Environment Protection Agency.
We are installing emissions control system on every industrial unit that is using boilers. We are inspecting new cars for emissions. For the first time, the government of Punjab is going to check the quality of fuel that is for sale.
Health officials in Punjab say doctors have treated over 1.8 million patients with respiratory illnesses since mid-October. Still, few wear masks despite government orders. Breathing toxic air is reducing life expectancy in Pakistan by almost 4 years, according to the Air Quality Life Index at the University of Chicago. As smog continues to hang over densely populated areas, Pakistanis may have to brace for many more sick days. Sara Zaman, VOA News, Islamabad.
And here are some more stories we're following from around the world.
The European Regulatory Committee now recommends approval of the Alzheimer's treatment called lecanemab just a few months after rejecting the drug. Biogen, the drug's manufacturer, said Thursday that the drug received a positive opinion from the European Medicines Agency as a treatment for early Alzheimer's disease. The European Commission is expected to decide authorization in the next few months.
On Thursday, it was announced that satirical news publication The Onion had bought Alex Jones's InfoWars at a bankruptcy auction with the backing of families of victims of the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting, a shooting that Jones claimed was a false flag operation employing crisis actors. For decades, Jones has used his platform to spread conspiracies and misinformation. The Onion plans to relaunch the InfoWars platform in January as a parody, with a pro-gun control charity being the sole advertiser.
A new report from the Pentagon has revealed hundreds of new reports of unidentified aircraft and aerial phenomena, but no indications of extraterrestrial life. In many cases, investigators determined that witnesses misidentified birds, balloons, aircraft, or satellites. In other cases, there just wasn't enough information to make a determination. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish.
And I'm Alexis Strobe. President-elect Donald Trump announced on Thursday he has selected Robert F. Kennedy Jr., an environmental activist who has spread misinformation on vaccines, to lead the Department of Health and Human Services, the United States' top health agency.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr., he came in. And he's going to help make America healthy again. To do some things, and we're going to let him go to it.
Kennedy ran for president in this year's election as an independent before dropping out in August and endorsing Trump in exchange for a role in the Republicans' administration. Kennedy is a noted skeptic of vaccines, which for generations have been considered safe by an overwhelming majority of doctors and scientists worldwide. Kennedy says he will let the science guide his policies.
All of my policies are going to be science-based, with the best science that's available.
Kennedy has also called for big changes at the U.S. Food and Drug Administration.
Our look at Donald Trump's domestic policies and priorities continues. Now, Trump may not be moving into the White House until January, but he's well underway in laying the groundwork and making plans for his administration's domestic policy. VOA's senior Washington correspondent Carolyn Persutti has the story.
Victory speech, election night, 2024.
We're going to fix everything about our country. And we made history for a reason tonight, and the reason is going to be just that.
President-elect Donald Trump's first priority is to fix immigration.
We're going to have to seal up those borders, and we're going to have to let people come into our country. We want people to come back in, but we have to let them come back in, but they have to come in legally.
Trump won over campaign crowds by vowing mass deportations, targeting millions of undocumented immigrants each year. Experts say this would cost billions of dollars and require massive organization and delegation, none of which has been detailed yet. But Trump's border czar pick, Tom Homan, told 60 Minutes he would focus on workplaces, not neighborhoods. The second priority is to fix inflation. Vice President-elect J.D. Vance also on election night.
And after the greatest political comeback in American history, we're going to lead the greatest economic comeback in American history under Donald Trump's leadership.
Trump pledges America First policies with tariffs on foreign goods and no tax on Social Security benefits or tips. The third priority, to fix the government.
America has given us an unprecedented and powerful mandate.
With that mandate, he appointed Tesla and SpaceX owner Elon Musk and former presidential rival Vivek Ramaswamy to head up government efficiency and look at bureaucracy and spending. Having a Republican-controlled Senate and House of Representatives will assure a smooth confirmation
for those already tapped for the Secretaries of State, Defense, and Homeland Security, Environmental Protection Agency head, United Nations and Israel ambassadors, and more. Just a few of the 4,000 government positions to be filled by Donald Trump. In less than 70 days, the president-elect takes over, and we will get a better picture of his second administration. But one thing is definite, it will be starkly different from the Biden years. Carolyn Pursuti, VOA News, West Palm Beach, Florida.
A hack of U.S. telecommunications systems linked to China, which initially appeared to focus on the American presidential campaigns, goes much deeper, according to investigators, and is likely part of a vast effort by Beijing to spy on the United States. The FBI and the U.S. Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency warned on Wednesday that the breach, first detected late last month, has now revealed a broad and significant cyber espionage campaign. For more, I spoke with VOA's national security correspondent, Jeff Selden.
Well, this is a longstanding fear by U.S. security officials, cybersecurity officials, and intelligence officials. Way back in February, they issued a warning about a group called Volt Typhoon that they said had been positioning itself within U.S. cyber systems and networks to launch potentially destructive cyber attacks that could actually jeopardize the physical safety of Americans. They said at that point it was the tip of the iceberg. Fast forward to just a couple of weeks before the U.S. election, and the FBI and the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency announced that there had been a compromise of U.S. telecommunication infrastructure and that the Chinese had gotten in. Now, and they said, and at the time, both the campaign of President Donald Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris said that their people have been targeted by this hack. Now, the FBI and CISA are saying that the Chinese hack was much broader than they realized, in that it was not just focused on the presidential campaigns and trying to capture some of the communications by the campaigns, but that the hackers would have been able to access customer call records, infiltrate private communications, and they said that applied to government officials and high-ranking politicians, and that the Chinese-linked hackers also appear to have been able to copy information that U.S. law enforcement have been requesting pursuant to court orders. So they say that this is much bigger than they thought, and it could get even bigger.
What has China's response been to the accusations?
Well, the U.S. has, of course, accused China of trying to break into its networks and into its systems many, many times. And the Chinese embassy in Washington, speaking for the Chinese government, has repeatedly dismissed the allegations, calling it disinformation, and then accusing the U.S. of being the biggest perpetrator of cyber attacks. In response to the latest accusations by the U.S. government, the Chinese embassy spokesman told VOA that this was a smear campaign against China, that there was no factual basis, and that they hope that eventually China and the U.S. can begin talking, basing their conversations and conclusions on what they call, quote, sufficient evidence rather than unfounded speculation.
VOA national security correspondent Jeff Selden, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.
Turning our attention now to Europe. Berlin, Germany, has become a center of Russian opposition in the years following Russian President Vladimir Putin's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Members of Russia's exiled opposition plan to lead a mass march on Sunday demanding the withdrawal of Russian troops from Ukraine, the prosecution of Putin as a war criminal, and the release of all political prisoners. Elizabeth Chernoff narrates this report by Ricardo Marquina.
The last major demonstrations against Russia's war in Ukraine took place on the streets of Moscow in mid-2022. The Kremlin has unleashed a massive police crackdown since then that has suppressed further demonstrations. Opposition activists have fled the country, many of them choosing the German capital of Berlin as their new home. Here, away from the Kremlin's reach, they are once again free to speak their minds, and that is what they plan to do on Sunday. One of the protest organizers is Olga Galkina.
Inside Russia, unfortunately, there is no possibility to hold such a march today, to speak out against Putin and against the war, to say no to Putin, that Vladimir Putin is a bloody dictator, that while Putin is in power, the war will continue.
At the head of the march will be recognizable figures of the opposition, such as Putin critic Vladimir Kara-Murza and exiled politician Ilya Yashin. Also participating will be Yulia Navalnaya, who recently told a British broadcaster she aims to follow in the footsteps of her late husband, Alexei Navalny, who was the de facto leader of the Russian opposition until his death in a Russian prison in February.
If ever I will come back to Russia, I will participate in the elections.
Russia's democratic opposition has historically been divided, if not at odds. But now, the march's organizers tell us, they are putting their differences aside and standing together against Putin. Again, organizer Olga Galkina.
For now, we all have one common goal, for Vladimir Putin to be punished as a war criminal and for the war in Ukraine to be completed as soon as possible.
The march will take place under a cloud of apprehension among Russian exiles over the upcoming transfer of power in the United States. March organizers worry that President-elect Donald Trump's campaign promise to end the war in Ukraine may favor Putin and end up strengthening the Russian leader's hold on power. For Ricardo Marquina in Berlin, Elizabeth Chernoff, VOA News.
Authorities in Sierra Leone have launched an Ebola vaccination campaign targeting health workers. Victoria Amunga reports from Kenema, Sierra Leone, narrated for us by Lori London.
The names of dozens of healthcare workers who died in the 2014 Ebola outbreak are displayed outside a hospital in Kenema, one of the worst hit cities during the two-year outbreak that killed nearly 4,000 people in Sierra Leone. Mohamed Feka, a healthcare worker, recalls how many of his co-workers died after contracting Ebola while caring for patients.
That greatly affected me. Looking at my, some social activity as well. Let me just ignore myself. Let me look at other people.
Now, there is an Ebola vaccination campaign to protect healthcare workers like Feka. The Gavi Vaccine Alliance in June launched a preventative Ebola vaccination program to help contain the disease and protect critical healthcare and frontline workers in high-risk countries like Sierra Leone.
There was just kind of fear among healthcare workers, even among the entire population. So upon taking the vaccine, I now have the confidence that maybe when there is an outbreak, I will not be infected.
The single dose vaccine is being provided to healthcare workers in countries that have had Ebola cases and those that border countries that have experienced Ebola outbreaks. Ali Khan is Gavi's communications director.
It's going to be 20,000 vaccines to start with, and we feel this is sufficient to cover, you know, the frontline workers I've just mentioned and protect those that are most vulnerable. And then, of course, we will be replenishing the stockpile so that we still have that 500,000 and then moving to other countries that are at risk of high risk of Ebola outbreaks.
The Ebola virus is spread through contact with the bodily fluids of an infected person. The average fatality rate for Ebola is about 60%, according to Gavi. Since Sierra Leone is considered a high-risk area, the government has set up a public health agency to enhance detection of the disease and prevent further outbreaks. Dr. Mohamed Alex Vandi is with the National Public Agency in Sierra Leone.
We know we are in an endemic zone. We know it's only the matter of when and not if that will be an outbreak. Every week we have a suspected case that we have to respond to. So a dedicated agency has been created to just look at that preparedness and response.
As part of the campaign, community and religious leaders are encouraging the public to accept the shots. The Reverend Usman Forna is one such leader.
We use the pulpit, the mosques use the minbar, the churches use the pulpit on Sundays and on Fridays, at Ricade meetings. Also at naming ceremonies, when we go to name children, we let the congregation that are present to know the value of vaccination.
More than 11,000 people died during the Ebola outbreak in West Africa between 2014 and 2016, most of them in Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea. Authorities hope the Ebola vaccination campaign will help avert such a disaster in the future. For Victoria Amunga, in Kenema, Sierra Leone, Lori London, VOA News.
And that'll wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America.
On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com.
In Washington, I'm Steve Karish.
And I'm Alexis Strobe.